step inside the tribe as our market experts share their boots-on-the-ground experience from the front lines of freight tech's emergence. I'm Tim Dooner, and this is Freight Waves Insiders. Welcome back to the show where we go inside the career journeys and brand stories of the people who make freight happen. Joining me today is a man who marches to his own beat. It's Uber Freight co-founder and head of operations, Bill Driegert. Bill, thanks for joining us today from lovely NorCal.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to join. Thanks for having me. Always good to be on these shows and appreciate having the opportunity.
Well, my favorite appearance of you ever on one of the shows I'm involved in was What the Truck, and I think it was about a year ago, and you pulled out that big digital kit that you have, and you beat the skins for us, man. How long have you been drumming for?
I've been drumming since I was in fifth grade, and then I played all through high school. I actually toured in a band in high school and then just kept up with it. I've probably played 200 plus shows live, and something that once you got it, you don't want to lose it. So I try to practice as much as I can.
I love it. There's a little punk rocker hanging out inside of you, just waiting to unleash itself on any great freight-related victory. It's really cool to hear. For those who don't know, I mean, the few people on Earth who may not have heard of Uber Freight, what's the elevator pitch on what your company does right now?
Yeah, so Uber Freight fundamentally is bringing the same visibility, transparency, flexibility, and ease of use of Uber to freight. And a lot of times I hear from senior executives that the first time they used Uber, they thought, why can't we have this in freight? And so that's what we've done, where it's one-touch execution for the carriers. They download the app, they hit a button, they book a load. And then on the shipper side, you get immediate visibility to rates and location of the trucks. And so behind that is this execution technology layer, which has really dramatically simplified how freight executes.
No, Bill, at this point in time, this snapshot in time, I can't turn on the TV these days without not just freight waves, not just the trade papers here, but every mainstream headline is concerning the supply chain. The White House just had a meeting of their task force to help get the ports move quicker. From your seat this week during this madness of the shipping crisis, how impacted are you or is Uber Freight by any of this?
So the impact of freight has been pretty continual since the middle of last year. We've seen elevated load-to-truck ratios, meaning the number of loads to the available trucks, at levels that have been higher than we've ever seen and sustained at that level now since middle of last year. That's resulted in elevated rates in the market. And what we've seen is that demand is the primary driver of that, and that people are just consuming more. Retail sales are up 20% plus, and they've stayed sustained. And we haven't seen them drop off. And of course, that's creating all these challenges in the supply chain. Within trucking, it's really reflected in those high rates. And then on the other side of the market, we've seen drivers, they left in droves immediately at the beginning of the pandemic, and they've slowly been coming back to market. And supply is coming, but demand is still so elevated that we're seeing that crunch. And that's really across all modes. We've seen these capacity challenges, and the pandemic has only exacerbated that. And with all the stimulus going into the economy, that's continued to maintain consumption and keep demand at an elevated level.
Yeah, it hasn't been easy. And it's a similar story. You just mentioned it. It's across all modes. Every single guest that we talk to on these shows, they've been hit by this in one way or another. And you also mentioned it's been sustained since March of last year. There was that big bottoming out. And then after May, the market, May of 2020, that trucking market recovered. It's been on that upward trajectory ever since, but unique times. And these are the kind of issues that I imagine when you were 16 years old, you probably weren't thinking about how to solve what's going on at a digital freight network or a digital freight broker or at a load board or at any of these things that are going on. When you were 16 and you were drumming, you've been drumming since you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I certainly was not thinking about freight. It was not top of mind, and I came to freight somewhat late in my career journey. When I was touring with the band in high school, I wasn't thinking about becoming a rock star, though a lot of the bandmates were, and they actually moved out to LA. I was thinking about cars and specifically building race cars. So all through high school, my other hobby was tinkering with cars and going to the drag strip and when I got to college, I went to Georgia Tech and I went to get a mechanical engineering degree. I joined the Formula SAE team, and my objective was to get a job at a race car fabricator or team. I then actually dropped out of school because I saw the opportunity to pursue my dreams early and moved to Vermont, of all places, to specifically build SECA Pro rally cars. And so I built these rally cars and sold tuning parts. And I did that for about 3 years, but it wasn't an industry where you make a lot of money, and wasn't an industry where I saw that it was going to progress what I wanted to achieve in life. And I ultimately decided to leave that and go back to school. And so then I actually moved back to Dallas, Texas, where I'm from originally, went back to school at SMU. And in the process of getting my degree there part-time, I took an intern opportunity at Frito-Lay, part of PepsiCo. And that was my entry into operations.
Yeah, I tried to have the cool job too, like out of college. I dropped out of college to work for a record label, and right as Napster was coming about. So I didn't make the best decisions either. And I had to sort of give up the ghost a little bit on that music dream. So we're kindred spirits in a little bit of a sense there. I remember when I joined the industry, I joined at a brokerage. I had no idea what it was. All I knew is that I got a paycheck and it paid for health insurance, and I was getting trained. So, I mean, it was something to do. When you got inside PepsiCo, what was the lure? Because you've been in supply chain ever since. So how'd you get trapped in the Roach Motel?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. So when I got to Pepsi, I actually had a very interesting opportunity within Pepsi. Within Frito-Lay, I worked on production planning systems, and I got placed in my internship with a bunch of operations research PhDs who had recently been hired from i2. i2 was a technology company that built optimization engines. Frito-Lay had bought their tooling. The company then went out of business, so they hired a bunch of employees to just manage that project. I got to work with them, which was a crash course in really planning systems and all of the, I'd say, more interesting back-end tech around optimizing supply chains. And I spent a total of about 6 years at Pepsi, working on production planning systems, going to all their facilities and optimizing how they made Doritos and how they made Gatorade or Quaker Oats. And it was actually a very interesting introduction into operations. But during that process, they actually sponsored me through a master's program at MIT. It's now the CTL program, where they have the supply chain management master's. There's, you know, several notable figures. Chris Kaplis and Yossi Sheffi are pretty notable throughout the industry. There are a lot of conferences and they're connected with that program. And in the process of going to that program, one of the students was an individual by the name of Jeff Silver. Jeff Silver had sold his company, American Backhaulers, to C.H. Robinson. After he left C.H., he had a 5-year non-compete. During that process, he went and got a couple master's degrees. One of those was in MIT. So I met him there. He started telling us all about freight brokerage. And part of the reason he was there is he actually wanted to recruit, because he had in his mind that he was going to go back into freight brokerage when his non-compete ran out, which is actually 3 years after the end of the program. So this was 2003, his non-compete ran out in 2006. But he was pitching us all on this concept of freight brokerage. And I think for me, it was like, oh yeah, no freight. You know, I do optimization. That's pretty cool. Freight doesn't sound quite as cool.
Yeah.
But he eventually sold us on the idea. One of the ways he actually sold us on the idea is he had such a good relationship with the C.H. Robinson team that he actually brought John Wiehoff, who was now, that was before he was CEO. Now he's the former CEO of C.H. Robinson, but he gave a presentation on C.H. Robinson. Funnily enough, out of that presentation, a lot of us thought, well, there really is an opportunity here. Clearly we can up level the technology and solve some of these issues in brokerage, because, you know, even back then, I recognized it seemed like an industry that just was ripe for better tech. And it's so information rich, because freight brokerage, you're dealing with millions of shippers and millions of loads and millions of carriers, to which you have this opportunity to just create better matches and a better network. I think we recognized that then. So I then left. I went back to Pepsi. And then in 2006, when Jeff's non-compete ran out, I gave him a call and said, hey, are you still planning on starting a company? And he said, yep. And came on as the fourth employee at Coyote Logistics. Mm-hmm. And even then, I remember telling my boss at Pepsi, and he was like, you really want to get into trucking?
Oh, I got to ask you that, because I remember when I was a customs house broker at FedEx Trade Networks, my account was Reebok. And I remember myself and the other brokers on the account, we'd always think to ourselves, like, if only we could get on the other side, if only we could get inside like Reebok and do it from their logo, it would be so much easier. Is it easier inside the shipper than it is inside the brokerage?
Yes and no. I mean, I think everyone throughout the supply chain has their own unique challenges they're dealing with. And just to close the loop on the freight piece, just to be clear, like, I love freight and it's been just eye-opening. We can get to that piece as well. But on the shipper side, I've actually had two opportunities to be on the shipper side. And one was at Pepsi and later at Amazon. And I do think one of the things that you see on the shipper side is that you focus a lot more attention on planning versus just the raw execution, meaning that there's a lot of investment in planning tools or TMS systems or systems that somewhat abstract the problem and make it a little bit easier, more manageable. Because freight is highly unpredictable and highly variant, and rates go up and down. And for a big shipper, that's just a lot to manage on a day-to-day basis. And ultimately, the front line is where a lot of that ends up falling. And I think within shippers, oftentimes there's too much investment in planning, not enough investment in execution system. I saw that at Pepsi. And in fact, even in the production planning side, we'd spend a lot of time building these planning systems. They would fall apart at execution. And then ultimately, it all just fell on the back of the people on the front lines regardless. And so I think within shippers, there's an opportunity to really up-level their execution capabilities, which that's partly a reason why I ultimately believe in what Uber Freight was building, is that we are very execution and frontline focused versus planning oriented. So to answer your question concisely, I think the shippers tend to focus a little bit too much on the planning, which they have to solve those problems, but by not focusing quite as much on the execution, it puts a little more pressure on the front lines in solving the issues in real time.
Now, having a perspective of a massive, right, shipper like PepsiCo, did that color your thinking at all when you go over to Coyote, where you're employee number four? And Coyote, by the way, as anybody in this industry knows, like, having that on your resume is like, if you're trying to get another job in trucking, it's almost like having gone to an Ivy League school. It's just one of those brands that's a good to have if you want to be on this side of the business. But what did you bring with you into Coyote, and what did you learn while you were there?
Yeah, and I can summarize what I learned at Amazon afterwards as well, because I think at each step I learned a little bit more that has all kind of come to the front as I've helped build Uber Freight. At Pepsi, I touched on this a little bit, but it was really that idea that execution is more important than planning. What I mean by that is, if you solve execution first, planning becomes less important. And what I saw at Pepsi is we were building these production planning systems, and then, of course, the plan would fall apart. Within the first shift, you'd be well off the plan. And then people are scrambling to correct. And then we hadn't built the tools to allow them to correct. So we quickly realized that we need to build just better execution tools, so when things go haywire, they can replan or readjust more quickly, and that will ultimately lead to better results than trying to come up with the perfect plan. So that was a big takeaway for me. At Coyote, the first thing I learned was sales matters. When you're fourth employee at a entrepreneurial organization, it's everybody's selling, everybody's telling the story, everybody's building the narrative, trying to understand who you're going to be as a company when you grow up, and rallying behind a very cohesive vision. And I think that selling and sales typically gets that intuitively. They get the importance of the narrative. They get the importance of just telling the story to everybody and anybody, not just to sell the company, but also to clarify for yourself what your vision is and what you're building and why it's important, where the value is for your shippers and your carriers or whoever your customers may be. And that ultimately nothing is more important, particularly for an early business who's still figuring that out. Nothing's more valuable than spending time with your customers. And for us, that meant with carriers and shippers. And so one thing that Jeff was very adamant about early on, which I thought was hugely valuable, is forcing everyone, including myself, to spend that time, to get on the phones, to do carrier sales, to do shipper sales, to learn the front lines, to be in that interaction on a daily basis, so that you really build an intuition for it, but a deep understanding of like what value you're solving for and what value you're bringing to that transaction. So understanding the importance of sales was something that I really think learned at Coyote more than anything. And for any entrepreneur, for anybody building a company, it's such an essential skill. And I can't overstate how important that is. At Amazon, very different business. So with Amazon, it was very much all about discipline and diligence, but also promoting a high degree of entrepreneurial autonomy within the individual. I think one thing Amazon does very well is try to empower everybody throughout the organization. But at the same time, they have a very high expectation for just managing to the metrics, delivering results, and high operational discipline. And by discipline, I mean having that WBR, you know, every week, just having that conversation, going through the metrics, going into the weeds, making sure that you understand your business top to bottom, and building that up. While at the same time, maintaining a culture of entrepreneurship and innovation to let people know that if they have a good idea, they have the autonomy to pursue that, which is actually in a very large company can often become rare, right? Because it just, you get too much bureaucracy and people don't feel like they have that autonomy. And it's something Amazon, I think, has done quite well.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you. So, I mean, this was circa 2014. Are you surprised at all? I mean, I'm not, but I start seeing some of the headlines now where people are getting almost alarmist about the size of Amazon, especially insofar as like NVOCC, 3PL, package integrator, basically their supply chain. It's just becoming this whole other monster, but I think it's been that way for a while. Does it surprise you at all that Amazon has grown into what it has?
No, because so many of the seeds that are bearing fruit now were planted, you know, decades ago. And that's one interesting thing, having worked at Amazon. I think anybody that's worked there, even for little two-year chunks in the last, you know, decade or two decades, has probably seen these same threads, they just keep growing and building, meaning that a lot of what they're doing now in the supply chain, building out 3PL capabilities, we were having those conversations years back. And so it's more of an evolution, and, you know, new leaders come in, but in the same race, right, with the same objectives, kind of continuing to build up these capabilities. Amazon, though, I think the one important thing to understand about their supply chain capabilities specifically is that it's for their own needs first. Most of the motivation behind why they build capabilities is because they know that they're going to be too big for others to handle, or that they're just going to have needs that are unique and distinct from what other providers can service. And when I was there, I spent a lot of time building out their final mile capabilities. And a lot of the thinking behind building out that final mile capability was, first and foremost, how do we most effectively serve our own needs? And it was high velocity residential delivery, you know, no commercial pickups, is where like FedEx and UPS have a lot of commercial. And so they're optimized slightly differently. And so our footprint, the type of vehicle we needed, the type of delivery station, it all was very specific to Amazon's needs. And I think where people freak out a little bit is that, well, what's the commercial threat? Are they going to go out and try to leverage this against other providers? And my general feedback to anybody is, well, they're going to focus on themselves first. And so that will always be the priority. And we've seen it in the way that they've turned away freight during times of peak. And so there's this, I think that diffuses the risk a little bit. Not, you know, Amazon is a massive beast, so I would never tell anybody not to, you know, watch what they're doing. But certainly their primary focus is always going to be that brown box and delivering the brown box at the lowest cost, the highest velocity that they can.
So you had some experience. You have well over a decade of seeing how a PepsiCo is run, how an Amazon is run, how Coyote is run. What came first, the idea of an Uber for freight, or Uber wanting a freight division that could be sort of like marketed behind the idea of Uber? When did this sort of come together, this idea?
The idea of Uber for freight started in 2012, and I can't claim that it was my idea or unique idea. I had presentations very early with Uber for freight, and I started pitching that idea even at Coyote back in 2012. But it was one of those moments where I think everybody was pitching Uber for this, Uber for that. And if you used the Uber application and you were in trucking, you could immediately intuit that there was an opportunity to build similar level of, you know, transparency and ease of execution within freight that just didn't exist in freight. And so I remember distinctly putting a presentation together in 2012 and pitching this idea that ended up developing into a product we called Coyote Go, which was our first mobile application. But I remember drawing this picture of like an X in the dispatcher. You know, the Uber gets rid of the taxi dispatcher. Like, we could disintermediate parts of this process. And there was certainly understanding and interest even back then. And the very first company that came to market was a company called Keychain Logistics in 2012. That was the first company I knew of that called themselves the Uber for Freight. And so, yeah, 2012. And then between 2012 and when we came to market as Uber, there were at least 47 companies that I counted that had called themselves the Uber for Freight. Early on, though, I think people didn't quite understand the difference between the app and the experience. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times you would talk about Uber Freight and they'd say, well, you know, there's already apps out there, or is it just the app? But what's really important to understand about what Uber is it's that whole experience, that ease of use. It's not the app is just the delivery mechanism. And a lot of the early companies, as a result, didn't really focus as much on that experience, where they would be more like a classifieds board that just happened to be on an app. A lot of companies were shipping the traditional experience just as the app as the interface, but not actually changing the experience of freight. Meaning, if I find a load and I still have to pick up the phone and call a broker, is that really an Uber-like experience? No, right? The Uber-like experience is, I find that load, I hit a button and I have it, and that's it, and I'm done. And so it took a long time to get to that point. But when we started, having seen 4 years of companies coming to market as Uber for Freight, trying to solve parts of this experience, it was pretty clear by the time we started what we needed to do. So I think it gave a lot of clarity. Plus, being within Uber was critical, because part of why I think a lot of companies didn't get the momentum is they just didn't have the resources or the technology or the brand recognition. All the momentum we got with Freight allowed Uber Freight allowed us to get to the point where we had enough volume in the network to prove out the model, and it allowed us to do that faster than a company just entering from zero. Because the other challenge with the freight market is it's so big, to actually make that experience work, you need a lot of freight in the network. And it can't just be freight that's like, that you don't have ownership from. It can't be classifieds listing. It has to be freight that you control, where you can actually make that experience better for the shipper and the carrier, and take out all the process steps and just make it a one-touch execution. To do that, you need a lot of freight. You need a very crisp technology platform. And Uber brought all that momentum and technology and capability and of course, funding early on to get us there.
So how did you ultimately land that? Obviously, like, the name Uber Freight, the brand value is so much there. I mean, yeah. The Uber itself, just the idea of it, as you said, it speaks for itself. You don't have to be like, I'm X company, which is the Uber of freight. You're literally Uber Freight. And everybody knows that Uber is someone with, with one business proposal on one end of the app and then someone on some other. There's a certain ease of use baked in, and there's some trust based on the name. But how did you land the gig? How did you ultimately secure the name Uber Freight and then be like, okay, let's make this investment. These guys know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's a great story, because it was, for me, it was like just this ideal alignment of the stars. So I had spent my time at Coyote. I knew the industry well, had that fortune of being in a company that was a tech leader that, as you mentioned, is like, you know, the Harvard of freight brokers in terms of building the right talent. And it was very, there's a lot of great things around Coyote that really gave me that foundation. Then that idea of Uber Freight, that seed was already planted. Then I spent a couple of years at Amazon, actually had the good fortune of being able to launch their freight brokerage internally as well, when they built that capability initially, but it was very internally focused. And then I actually left freight and got totally out of the freight industry, because after Amazon, so it was an excellent company. I really enjoyed my time there, but I was really hungering for that startup experience again, which I think was the most enjoyable part of being at Coyote. You learn the most, you're in control, you're building, and there's just something so satisfying about building something from nothing. And I think I was really hungering for that again. So I left and took a COO role at a company called Pillow Homes here in San Francisco, which was actually short-term property management. So totally out of freight. And, you know, I thought, I'll try something new, or get into a new industry. It was a great opportunity, great team, great investors, met the board and just felt really good about it, came on board. But almost immediately, I got connected with the team at Otto, which was the autonomous trucking company that Uber acquired. I got connected with them through a contact that I had known from my time at Coyote, who was a writer for Forbes. He was an MIT alumnus, and I had met him at an alumni event. A guy named Chunka Moy. He had written this multi-part story in Forbes about autonomous vehicles. And this was back in 2012, I believe, very early on. In fact, it was the first really detailed, thorough article I'd seen about autonomous vehicles. It was really theorizing what the future might bear for them and how it might evolve. And one of the people he had interviewed was Anthony Lewandowski, who's one of the founders of Otto. There's a lot of articles about him. I won't get into all of that, but I met him. I met Lior, and they, you know, was a brilliant pair of people, still are today. It's a brilliant set of individuals that were at Otto building this company. You know, back then, 2016, there was an incredible amount of excitement around autonomous vehicles and trucking. And I always had believed that trucking would be the first market to launch autonomy, because you can control the problem space more effectively, because you can build a commercially viable business, even if you just solve for one lane. And so it just seemed like a natural place to start, because there's a little lower threshold to make a viable commercial enterprise in trucking. And so met them. We started talking about how to deploy AVs, what that could look like. The idea of an Uber for freight was really only at that point in service of this idea of how we could build a platform to deploy these autonomous vehicles more effectively and more precisely. And as the Uber acquisition then came through, there was an opportunity to pitch this idea of Uber for freight as part of that broader vision of autonomous trucking within Uber. And so we did that, and we pitched it back then. It was to Travis, and there was a very small team at Otto that had been working on this part of the problem, including a few people that we had hired from freight backgrounds. And there were, by pure coincidence, there was also a team, a very small team, that had been pitching this idea of Uber for freight within Uber. And as I learned later, there had been a couple times that this idea had been pitched, and they had pitched it to Travis, and Travis knew that they were pitching this idea. I said, you guys all should come together and just build this up. And so we got together, pitched it to Travis as a joint entity, and then he gave us the thumbs up, and that was the seed. And at that point, for me, I had been working on that idea for on and off for 6 years. And so I think we were able to cut through a lot of the issues that would have gotten in the way if we were just coming from zero, didn't have that, I'd say, clarity of perspective on what we needed to build right out of the gate, and really what the Uber experience meant and how to get very precise with how to just improve the transaction on both sides of the market. And I think one thing that we did as Uber Freight that was unique was right out of the gate, it was just, we got to solve for the carrier, we got to solve for the owner operators, we've got to have upfront pricing, it's got to be that one touch execution, download the app, hit a button, and you've got the load. Because that experience did not exist in the market, and it felt just very fundamental to what Uber was and what an Uber-like experience should be. Because if I'm using Uber, it's all there, I hit a button and the truck shows up. It was a bit of a flip of perspective, though, because within the carrier market, we really solved for the carrier first, because the shipper, we always knew, was going to have a slightly different experience. And so it was very carrier-centric out of the gate, meaning the shipper, to our conversation earlier, they've somewhat abstracted the problem. And so it's unlikely a shipper is going to download an app and hit a button and book a load, versus we knew that we could provide that to the carriers and it'd be very Uber-like right out of the gate. And so that was the long version of how we got to be Uber Freight. But for me, it very much felt like the end of a journey, because it was something that I'd been thinking about and trying to push for 6 years. And to have the opportunity to do it at Uber was just the realization of a dream. And so it's been amazing to see it actually come to fruition, and to start from, again, starting from zero. Our first load, it was just calling shippers in Texas and calling carriers and everybody hustling. And I remember early on, we had our team, we were all commingled with the engineers, and San Francisco, I'd say normal hours are like 9 to 10 that come in the office. Well, if you're managing freight, as you know, it's really like 7 a.m. East Coast. And if you're in Chicago, most brokers have people in the office, or a few people between 6 to 7 to get the day started. And so you're in the West Coast, you're already disadvantaged in terms of time zone. And then the office culture is really starting at 9 to 10 and staying later, right? It's not in sync. So I remember day one I started, it's like, we got to get in here at like at least 5:30 or 6 to even have a hope of booking a load. So, it wasn't unpopular, because I think everybody was just hyped to get going and to start moving freight. But yeah, it was all hands on deck out of the gate. And to see it come from that to now, you know, we've got, you know, well over $1 billion of run rate. And of course, with the Transplace acquisition, it's just it's a much, much larger enterprise, and all that in 5 years. It's been pretty amazing to watch.
Well, and if you had waited for autonomous trucks, you'd still be waiting. So my natural question now is, at what point did you realize that this wouldn't be a pure autonomous play, and you really got to start thinking about interacting with the market as it exists now?
That was, I'd say, there's two parallel things happening. One was that freight was doing well, right? And that we had our own journey, and we were building this freight brokerage tech capability and building the technology and seeing the benefits of it. So that was happening on one trajectory. The other is that there was a slow realization on the AV side that it's a longer path. And if you had asked me in 2016, I would have said, yeah, by 2021, these trucks will be everywhere. They'll be all over the road. If you ask me now in 2021, I'll say it's probably another, you know, 10 plus years out, right? That we will see a slow ramp. I don't want to be definitive on that because I haven't kept up with it, but certainly my perspective has shifted. And it was a realization of just how difficult that long tail of problems is to solve within autonomy. I'm still super bullish on autonomy on a long enough horizon. It's just that there's so much space within that horizon to solve like fundamental freight challenges that we knew on the freight side, we just had to keep building and focus on our product, our technology, because we also fundamentally believe then and still believe that if we build the best execution platform, it doesn't matter if it's an AV, it doesn't matter if it's an electric vehicle, it doesn't matter if it's a traditional 53-foot trailer, that we can plug all that in because we've got this back end that just manages the execution so seamlessly. And we got the carriers, we have the shippers on the platform, and that the capacity then is somewhat interchangeable. There's a lot of details to make that work, but I still fundamentally believe that if you have a great execution platform, the AV should layer on top of that as another mode, as another way of moving the freight around.
No, I have to agree with you. I mean, and I was in the same place in 2016. It really seemed like we'd be closer. And as I work at FreightWaves and I get to talk to these companies and see where they're at with some of this technology, not only do I understand the pivot, but especially for over-the-road trucking, it actually seems like it's a much longer way out than it even did 5 years ago. So much so that it seems like now the Uber app itself, like Uber driver app, will be more automated than freight will be in the near future. In fact, they're already doing some like closed testing with the automated cars. Uber, very interesting animal. The name carries a lot of weight to it, right? And it's gotten some criticism to Uber Freight before. When did you realize that Uber Freight wasn't the same thing as Uber? I'm sure you knew that kind of early on, but what were some of the challenges there where there's a differentiation?
Yeah, the name Uber definitely carries a lot of different, I'd say, connotations with it. And I saw that right out of the gate. And I had to learn how to filter that out a little bit, in the sense that, we started this in 2016. 2017 was a difficult year for Uber, no matter how you look at it. And then with Dara Kemp coming on board, he's, I think, just done an exceptional job of stabilizing the company, just maturing us as an organization. I would say Uber grew so fast and so quickly that, I mean, it was unlike anything that had come before, really. The Uber growth story is still singular in the sense of how quickly it grew. So growing that fast, I've heard I heard an analogy for another company that grew fast about being like a toddler in an adult's body. And it felt a little like that, where there were just a lot of things that hadn't matured yet with the organization. And so building Uber and Freight inside of that was, on one hand, you get the benefit of all the momentum behind Uber and the technology. On the other hand, you know, you're in the middle of a company that's going through a very rapid maturation phase. And so you've got, you know, we were fortunate in that because we came through this acquisition, we were always a little bit, I would say, off to the side early on. And we had always had a fair amount of autonomy. Our leadership and the leadership of Uber did a great job of just giving us the runway to do our thing and keep building. And then the, you know, we could manage the, what was happening and keep it at arm's length, right? In terms of, you know, we of course are part of Uber and we leverage Uber and we benefit from all the technology and all the systems and all the momentum that's come with that. And so on the plus side, got access to the tech, got access to the people, got access to all the infrastructure as it was evolving. On the negative side, right, it's that we do have, there has been a public perception of Uber that we've had to, I'd say, evolve, and that Dara has done a great job of just uplifting since he came on board as well. And Uber Freight within that, when we went to market early on, that I think the Uber name still at a enterprise level carried so much positive connotation because, again, I think that if you're a VP of transportation or director of transportation, and if you've used Uber and had used Uber and were familiar with that experience, you wanted that within the your transportation department. And we heard that quite a lot early on. And so we had a lot of great conversations with very large enterprises early on who were just eager to have that same experience translate to Freight. And that gave us a lot of credibility very early on, where if we had just been another company calling ourselves Uber Freight, we would not have had that same level of credibility. The fact that we were within the Uber umbrella gave us that credibility, gave us that momentum, and was a huge lift for the first couple of years. I'd say since then, we've definitely carved our own brand. People know what Uber Freight is. We've built a reputation in the market. We still, I think, get a premium in terms of just click rates and PR because we have the Uber Association. And, you know, Uber as a org continues to, of course, evolve and become this, I'd say, just foundational transportation company. It's just part of our lives. So that's really, I think, the opportunity for Uber. So you take Freight, you take rides, you take Eats, you combine all these things, and like anything you want to get around, any place you want to go, right? It's all through this one transportation layer that we're building across the economy. So,
yeah. But I was going to say, I don't think what you're saying there can really be understated either, because if you think back to like 2016 and the state of trucking freight brokerages and the state of Uber Freight and how much they've both morphed. And a lot of them are looking sort of similar, you know, Uber Freight taking on aspects of more traditional brokerages, most brokerages that are trying to compete, taking on aspects of your Uber Freight, or at least getting ushered into this era of digitization. It's gotta be interesting to see. Does it make you happy to see that impact on the industry?
It does. And I am no more happy than when I see another competitor do something that we did, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, because one, I do believe that, you know, part of what we can, the positive impact we can have on this industry is to just up level the experience for carriers and shippers. And I would particularly emphasize the carrier side, because I do think small to mid-sized carriers particularly have had a difficult go of it pre-2016. And I think fundamentally why we've been successful is that we made their experience better and we uplifted it. And I think early on there was a lot of skepticism around some of the aspects of what we did, and particularly around upfront pricing and, you know, fast payment, some of the things that are so fundamental on the carrier side and so uplifting in terms of their experience, that for us, I think it was always a must have. It was clear that this would just make that side of the transaction better. But from a traditional broker perspective, you're giving away a lot of control, right? As soon as you show prices in an application, then are you brokering anymore? You're not negotiating, right? There was a lot of apprehension behind that. But from an owner operator, that is empowering and uplifting, because now I have a rate, and then I can call another broker and I can negotiate, or I have a load I can accept at 2 a.m., right? It's just, I have more information, more optionality, more flexibility. And just like that, the way I interact in the market has shifted. And so I always too thought that if we did that and we got momentum behind it, that it would be inevitable that the market would move in that direction. And so we came to market, there was initial pushback and just the fundamental mechanics of how we built the product, which was hit a button, book a load, and, you know, no negotiation, no bidding, upfront prices. It's all super simple. And the reason I thought it would never go backwards is because I always, and I still believe, that is the best experience as a carrier. Now, some carriers, we have added bidding. Some carriers do like to bid. Sometimes a lane, prices aren't well known. But if the prices are known, I always liken it to going to Amazon, hitting a button and getting your Xbox, right? If you know the Xbox is, let's say, $400, and you go to Amazon, you hit a button, you get it, and you're good, right? It shows up the next day, and that's probably the best way that transaction can execute. If you find that Xbox on eBay and it's up for bid and you think maybe I can get it for $450, but I'm going to put a bid at $445 and it gets sniped at $455 at the last minute, right? That's not a good experience, and you end up paying more than market, and it's not the cleanest or best way of engaging. Or even, the next step down would be somebody advertises one for $550 on Craigslist, and I go meet them in a parking lot, and then I try to offer them $450. They say, sorry, we do it for $525. And then they give me a box that has no Xbox in it, right? That's like, that last example is how I liken kind of pre-Uber freight technology, and that there's more of classifieds listings, right? You're calling, you're negotiating, you don't know what you're going to get. There's a lack of transparency, right? And so I always thought that the more transparent, easier, simpler transaction, that's where the market has to go. And so when we came to market, that was, to me, the biggest innovation we brought. And pricing, I can't overstate too how important getting pricing right is to that, because that's probably the most technically challenging part, is just putting a price that makes sense. But what we've seen since then is, of course, everybody's started to build their own version of that. And so we've seen a lot of the brokers and a lot of the large carriers come to market quickly after with very similar experiences. And for us, it's validating. It's, of course, it does mean more competition in the market. And so as a, competitor, as a business, clearly, we want to know that we've got the best unique experience and that we're continuing to push the boundary. But having more competition, it's a healthy state of the market. And I think in some areas, it only accelerates the value prop, because a good example of that is on the other side of the market. We were the first to come to market with upfront pricing for shippers as well, where they could get an API integrated into their TMS. You hit a button, they get a price. Sounds very simple, but it just didn't exist in the market until 2019. And so we launched with SAP, and then quickly we've expanded to most other TMSs. But what we saw was immediately there were a lot of our competitors were like, we did this one, we did this one. And there was a lot of follow on with those API integrations across the TMS ecosystem. And then, of course, with shippers. That massively accelerated through the COVID, through the pandemic, because shippers wanted to get good, quick information. But I think the other reason it accelerated was that there was competition. Because if it was just us trying to sell just our API with a big shipper, well, the shipper wants to know that they can get a competitive rate. They're going to want to see other options. Having other providers in that mix means that other people are telling that same story to the shipper, that, hey, this is a better way of getting rates. This is the future, right? This is a better experience. And we've got multiple voices telling the same story, then all of a sudden that market expands very rapidly, because it was just a better way of engaging with the spot market. And the fact that we were first is very validating, but the fact that others came to market is also very validating. And the fact that there's now competition will just accelerate that segment. And then it's on us to just keep innovating and stay a step ahead. Because I'm also a big believer in this market. Like, you can't win on unique ideas or big ideas alone, because there's nothing, this is not a market where you can keep secrets. because carriers talk to customers, the shippers talk to brokers, talk to carriers, talk to, there's just too many information channels and too many people move through organizations that it's very hard to keep secrets around products particularly. So you can't win on, I think, long-term on product innovation because people are going to come right behind you with the same idea or try to replicate it very quickly. You have to stay ahead of that and try to push on through better execution. But it's also very validating when you do see competitors come to market with very similar tech or very similar solutions, because then it's like, yes, it is a good idea, right? It's, because the worst thing is you come up with what you think is a great idea and then, you know, nobody copies it. Nobody does it.
People don't copy bad ideas. Yeah. People don't. I mean, I remember, it seems like just yesterday, I know it was a couple of years ago, but like one of the arguments when you guys started gaining traction was, oh, you know, bringing a board and transparency to the market is going to crash and tank drive-in rates, and it's going to go across all modes and it's going to be terrible. I mean, right now in Sonar, we're near the top that we've ever had in rates that we've ever pushed through, because supply and demand are what are going to drive these rates. It's not necessarily technology. Optimization may help you in all of those things. But speaking of the technology, let's talk about the drivers for a second. You know, your app is nothing without people on either end of it to make this transaction work. How did you get drivers to come on board? They typically can be a little trepidatious about trying new technology.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time with driver outreach and really listening to drivers, and we set up a carrier council very, very early on. We also reached out to a lot of influencers in the space early on to get their opinion, to have them on site, just understand what their needs were. We also reached out to industry organizations to, you know, give them to show them what we were doing, what we were planning. We wanted to be very driver forward and push the boundary in terms of how much value and how driver centric we were. And having been in the freight industry before, brokers aren't always driver-centric. I think the brokers have gone through an evolution of being more driver-centric and being more carrier-centric. But I would still say that when we came to market, there was a lot more room. There was a lot more opportunity to uplift that in terms of engaging with drivers. So I think the number one thing we did was just listen and then build a better product and a better way of getting freight. And then drivers, once they got used to that, we've seen incredible engagement. We've also done, we've had an independent brand survey, which showed that drivers very much value our brand over other brands. And I think it's because we've been very driver-centric since the beginning. We went to GATS and MATS and a lot of the carrier shows as well. And within our segment, that's another area where I think we were the first to really have big presence at some of these shows and be out there. And just, again, listening to carriers, listening to drivers, being very engaged in the community. It's something, too, that I look forward to getting back to some of these shows kind of post-pandemic because they've been canceled through the through the pandemic. It's building a product that's valuable. We're also continuing to invest in new products that are driver-centric to help lower their cost of operating and to help bring them additional benefits. So for us, it's just continuing to be at the forefront of bringing new capabilities and trying to be responsive. And we still, like any company, there's still a lot of things we can improve on. And so listening to drivers and knowing when we do get something wrong that we're fixing it and being open about that is also just a critical step.
Now, in its easiest understanding, Uber Freight is, you know, similar to Uber. It connects the load to the driver and all of that. But how has Uber Freight grown since then to expand into other services, you know, make the whole thing a little bit stickier, offer more management for those looking in that direction? What are some of the growth aspects and products that you're mentioning that are a key focus of yours right now?
Yeah, the things I look most forward to are how we can help our carriers and our shippers manage larger sets of freight or manage across contracts or multiple loads or bids. We started very transactionally, load by load by load. We then added bundles, which was stringing loads together for our carriers. We've since added real-time contracting on both sides of the market, where a shipper can get a 3-month rate and a carrier can make a 3-month commitment, what we call our committed capacity. there's opportunity to continually up-level those capabilities. And particularly now, as you know, we look forward to a future with our partners at Transplace, I think there's significant opportunity to just be thoughtful about how we build deeper solutions in terms of, you know, contractual, long-term contracts. I'm a big believer that I don't think the RFP will ever go away, but I do think the RFP becomes automated. I think that contracts become automated. I think that just as we've done spot pricing APIs, we'll have price or APIs for contract rates and on both sides of the market. So I really look forward to a future where carriers can contract on, you know, longer commitments. And I think that there's a future where the way that we go to market and the way that we plan freight just becomes a touch-free, you know, low friction, effortless process, as where now it is a very high friction, high effort process. Freight will always be volatile. It's just the nature of how we consume things. You know, we drink more water in the summer, and we'll always drink more water in the summer, and thereby the weather will determine our water consumption. So freight will be as volatile as the weather is. And that's just something we have to manage. And back to the execution layer being primary, if we build better execution tools, we solve it. And then if we build tools that can mitigate that execution in different ways through short-term and long-term contracts in real time and just being more thoughtful about how we optimize capacity, I think that's what I get excited about. Of course, on the service lines, we do, you know, reefer, flatbed, and van. We also do some volumes in Canada. We've added LTL capabilities with Uber now doubling down on our direct capability and our delivery capability. There's a lot of interesting opportunities to think about how these things start to bundle together. A lot of that will, you know, come over the next several years, but I'm very excited about this broader transportation capability that Uber is building out and how that starts to fill in a lot of space in terms of needs for our shippers and our partners.
I would have to think you have to be looking pretty hard at Final Mile.
Well, Uber does have this direct product. And so we do, I mean, Eats is a delivery solution and Uber Direct is a delivery solution. And it's a point-to-point delivery solution. We have some very large customers signed up in that space. And certainly it's, you know, as you know, there's just so many niches and capabilities across the supply chain that are very specific and require very specific solutions. But underlying all that, you always have some core transportation needs. And that's where Uber, I think, has the best just core execution capability and technology for fundamental just transportation management. And there's a lot of areas that we can leverage that. So I look forward to that, expanding that.
Well, I guess my last question for you is then, as you move forward, you look forward, you want to grow and you want to expand, how do you also make sure that Uber Freight stays what it is, right? There's got to be, you mentioned all these different things, that, especially being from the brokerage world, you know, there's all these different holes you can plug and you know, fingers to stick your pie in, and there's all these different opportunities out there, but how do you decide what's going to be right for Uber Freight moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. Fundamentally, our core business is still truckload transportation and moving things from, you know, full truckloads from point A to point B. And there's a massive market domestically. It's an $800 billion space. And that still presents a huge opportunity to you know, bring better solutions and to for our own growth opportunities, but for our shippers and for our carriers as well. And so that's still is and will be our primary focus. There's still a lot, as I mentioned, with the contract opportunities, there's a lot of interesting opportunities just up level tech, and we still have a long journey there, and it's such a huge market, and I look forward to what we do in that space as well. But fundamentally, it makes sense for Uber and Uber Freight if we believe we can bring a unique solution, if we believe that our tech brings really uplifts the experience for the parties on either end of that transaction, be it shippers or carriers or, you know, riders and drivers. If we aren't bringing a unique advantage that is Uber specific, then it becomes less interesting. So I get asked a lot about, you know, this mode or that mode, and there's a lot of modes where you just don't have that same opportunity for Lyft. And so as I think about what fits within the Uber Freight ecosystem, it's really where can we provide the most, first and foremost, where does our tech provide the most unique benefits and value, and how can we leverage that for our shippers and carriers in unique ways or new ways as we expand?
Well, hey, Bill, thank you so much for letting us step inside your world today. Folks, if you want to learn more about the show, you can always follow me on Twitter at Timothy Dooner. That's D-O-O-N-E-R. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get podcasts. Just look up FreightWaves Insiders. Or if you want every FreightWaves podcast all in one convenient place, look up FreightCast. Every single show is there. I think there's like four a day that we upload. It's going gangbusters. Going a little bit like Uber Freight out there. Hey, Bill, one more time. Thank you again.
No, thanks, Tim. It's great.